On June 14th, a man dressed as a police officer came to the home of a Minnesota state representative and shot and killed her and her husband. He then went to the home of a state senator and shot and wounded him and his wife. Apparently, he had a hit list of 45 elected officials. He was apprehended in what was said to be the largest manhunt in the state's history. We've seen a proliferation of political violence. President Trump was at a political rally, as we know, and there was an assassination attempt. There was a Pennsylvania governor whose house was burned in an act of violence relating to his politics. Now, with us to discuss who's doing these kinds of crimes and why? And why is there more, or does it just seem like there's more? Our expert is Dr. Jillian Peterson. She's a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University in Minnesota. She has a PhD in psychology and social behavior. She was on a three-year grant from the U.S. Department of Justice focusing on understanding the life histories of mass shooters. She's been a regular commentator in the media on CSNBC, at CNN, Fox News, etc. She's an expert in the area of forensic psychology, mental illness, justice system, violence prevention, and data-driven public policy. Dr. Peterson, thank you so much for joining us with your expertise today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So let's get right into this. When you have studied mass shootings, including school shootings, and have put together databases to try to identify causes and to try to identify different factors that contribute to the violence. The kind of violence that we saw with these Minnesota shootings, and you're up there, you're up in the state of Minnesota, so you were there to experience the terror that was going on. Is this akin to mass shootings? Is there the same kind of considerations when it comes to the causes as in a mass shooting?
You know, there is a lot of similarity. I think we're still understanding the extent of it, but the goal of mass shootings and the goal of political violence, it is to create this fear and this terror. It is to make headlines. You are kind of putting your own name in the history books. So there's this quest for the perpetrator to be known and watched and witnessed, and it's this way to kind of get your message out to the world. So in those ways, they are really similar. We also know that the perpetrators tend to be men, typically white men, who are of mental health histories, who are kind of in a state of crisis, who are suicidal. And so there does seem to be a number of overlapping risk factors.
And let's get into that a little more. You said many of them have mental health issues. And, you know, I hear a lot, Dr. Peterson, where people say, what was his motivation and what prompted him to do it? And I don't think of it that way. I think of it as what was going on in his life where he felt like this was the only option that he had, right? Because a person, no matter how strong they feel about the political justice system or the political system, you know, they're not going to go take a gun and shoot people. So what kinds of backgrounds do the people who do this political violence generally have?
No, we know that they seem to be angry that their lives are not going the way they want them to go. Typically, there's a big incident or a relationship loss, a job loss, something that kind of sets them on this pathway. And they go from this sort of what's wrong with me, I'm a failure, and it shifts where it's like, whose fault is this? And who can I hold responsible? We call it an aggrieved entitlement. They kind of think that they're owed something that they did not get. And so they're going to go and hurt people as a result. And the goal of these violent acts is to make headlines, is to be known, is to force people to see you. And they're also typically final acts. The perpetrator knows they're going into this and not coming out.
And they don't care.
I mean, they don't care, exactly.
Yeah. So when you talk, let's talk, answer this question, and then we have to go to a break. But you talk about school shootings. You cited four situations that are almost always present in the suspect. And I think these are very interesting and kind of parallel what we're talking about. Can you give those four situations that are present in a suspect?
Yeah, we see this really consistent pathway over and over again when it comes to school shooters, mass shooters. It's early childhood trauma, really significant neglect, abuse, sexual violence. We see this leading to a crisis point in the perpetrator's life where they are showing people that they're not doing well, they're acting differently, they're actively suicidal. Third is they study other shooters that came before them, they get radicalized, they spend time in chat rooms where this type of violence is really validated and celebrated, and then finally they have access to guns and access to the people that they kind of hold responsible for how miserable they are.
At any of those points in time, when can this be undone? Is there a point in time that is the most important time where if we see this happening, we can stop it? I mean, clearly you don't abuse and neglect children, because when that happens, that doesn't always mean they're a school shooter, but it's not a good thing. But at what point, Dr. Peterson, can this kind of behavior be predictable?
I think the most critical point is that kind of crisis point. Typically, perpetrators tell other people they're thinking about this. They're leaking their plans, as we call it, in the psychology world. There's lots of warning signs. Not necessarily people know it's going to happen, but they know something is really wrong, and they don't know what to do. And so I think that becomes a really important spot where we need reporting systems, we need intervention teams, we need a plan for what we do when someone is showing that they are at risk to themselves and others.
Dr. Peterson, why do you think we're seeing more of these political assassinations or assassination attempts?
It's hard to know exactly, but we do know that public violence like this is socially contagious. So when one makes headlines, for example, when a mass shooting makes headlines, we're at a really high risk for another mass shooting for about 2 weeks. There's this contagion element to it. And I think we're starting to see that with political violence and with assassinations and assassination attempts in general. It seems to be, and we are tracking these things, we are certainly in a blip right now. It's hard to know if this is going to continue escalating, but we have never in this country had this many assassination attempts in this short period of time.
Can you attribute any of this in some way, shape, or form to the internet? And one of the things that you talked about in the four prongs with school shooters and mass shooters is this idea that there's a radicalization, how they go online and they find people who think alike and they find people who are legitimizing their discomfort or their anger. Do you think that might be a cause of seeing this proliferation?
Absolutely, I do. I think social media really is an accelerant in terms of the radicalization process, because you don't have to know your neighbor who thinks this way. You literally have access to everyone in the world, and you can find these really dark spaces where hate and anger and violence are seen as, you know, okay ways to deal with your problems, where school shooters are celebrated or assassins are celebrated. And social media companies, I think they're trying to figure out what to do with these spaces, but it's really hard, especially when all your users are anonymous.
And yeah, I mean, we've got First Amendment issues, right? And people that talk about things are not committing a crime necessarily. It's when they act on it. But has there ever been a study about how do you infiltrate these sites, or how do you interfere or disrupt these conversations that become very, very dangerous?
You know, I think that's an area of research that is just emerging right now. There was a push to kind of deplatform these groups, to take pages down and take things away. What we found is that they show up in other spaces. They don't entirely disappear. And so thinking about how do you put people in these rooms to maybe de-escalate or to maybe try to change thinking, that is really kind of new spaces for research right now.
You know, I listened to an interview that you did, and this comment was very chilling, and I may be kind of making it more simple than it should be, but you were talking about whether or not schools should have people who are armed in the schools. And, you know, there's a divided thought process. Should we have people with guns? Should we not have people with guns? Should we have teachers with guns? And one of the statistics about when you have armed people in the schools was really, really interesting. Can you share that with our listeners?
Sure. This was a study we did where we looked at 133 either school shootings or attempted school mass shootings, where the perpetrator came in heavily armed with the goal of shooting indiscriminately. That's how we defined it. And we were shocked to find that actually when there was an armed officer on the scene of the school shooting, more people died. And I think, you know, I've interviewed school shooting perpetrators, and they will say, you know, like, I was a student of the school. I knew there was an armed officer there. Being shot by him was actually part of my plan. I think there's also, you know, school shooters are insiders of the school. They know everything that's going on there. And so they kind of use that armed officer as part of their plan.
And that's just really, really chilling. I have a texter who said, when the person at the top of our political system incites violence, et cetera, then what else can you expect? You know, and I know this is political and all of that, but I mean, and let's just talk about both sides of the aisle, you know, being polarized. Mm-hmm. You know, it's true that we are much more polarized than we've ever been. But I know in your state, you have said that your government is not as polarized as maybe other states, but still you had this horrific killer, you know, do what he did. So how does that affect this polarization, this idea that, you know, you're either good or bad and there's nothing in between?
Yeah, I do think it absolutely has an impact. I mean, we can talk about the psychology of the perpetrator, but then there's also kind of the sociology of what's happening in our country at the same time. And I think when we have extreme polarization, when you are using hateful language, when that's becoming more normalized from everybody, that absolutely does contribute. But it is true. We were all so shocked because in Minnesota, we're a state kind of known for being able to get things done across the aisle, for being quote unquote Minnesota nice. It's just not a space where there is a lot of kind of political hatred. And so it was very shocking to see it happen here.
And not that we know everything about the shooter, and I'm not going to name his name, because one of the things that you have said, Dr. Peterson, is that we don't want to, you know, make him into anything that other than just a killer, if he in fact is guilty. Of course, we have to presume him innocent. But is there anything about his background that you know that sort of says, yeah, he's the type that may have done this kind of thing?
It's still so early, and I think as information is trickling out, it's actually been confusing. Clearly, there was a lot of planning. The fact that he was dressed as a police officer, the fact that he was charged with stalking, you know, that he'd clearly spent a lot of time at these people's homes. It seems like he was kind of a failed businessman, maybe kind of a wannabe businessman who couldn't ever get anything off the ground. And then there's also some rumors that maybe he was kind of psychotic, that some of his writings were really rambling, and that he was maybe in a psychotic crisis. But it takes a while for all the information to come out.
Absolutely. Now, I want to talk about red flag laws. And I think you have talked about how they do actually help. And I'm sure that some of these studies are still in the inception. Can you just briefly tell our listeners what a red flag law is and what you think about how they help ameliorate these issues?
Yeah, a red flag law or a extreme risk protection order, extreme risk protection law, it's a way to remove guns from somebody who is in a crisis. So it is, the court has to determine that this person is in acute danger of hurting themselves or someone else based on actions that they've taken or things that they've said. And it's a way to temporarily remove firearms, usually for 6 months or maybe for a year, while that person works through that crisis and gets the help that they need, and then you give them back. And it's the research is showing early on that it seems to be an effective tool, because a lot of times families are really worried about a loved one and don't know what to do. And so this is a way, you know, it's not a criminal charge. You haven't actually committed a crime. It's just a way to come in and temporarily remove access. And people across kind of both sides of the aisles, gun owners, non-gun owners, kind of can get behind this idea.
Dr. Jillian Peterson, where can people, what is your cause, and tell people where they can donate if they're so inclined?
Sure. I run a research center called the Violence Prevention Project Research Center, and our goal is to use data and research to reduce violence in society and to make us all safer. So we're really a nonpartisan, research-focused organization, and we can always use donations. Our website is theviolenceproject.org.
Thank you so much for joining us.